Hey, everybody, it's Leonard Maltin, and this is Maltin on Movies. Without Baron Vaughn today, he's working on Grace and Frankie, the highly acclaimed TV series. It is a TV series, but you can watch it on your TV, watch it on your devices. You can watch it anywhere you darn well please. But he's not here. I'll tell you who is here, though. Phil Rosenthal.
Hello.
Welcome, Phil.
It's great to be here.
And we'll talk more about your current activities and such, but I just want to say it's nice to have you here as a fellow film buff.
Oh, listen.
As well as a creator of comedy.
I don't think you have a peer. I'm a fledgling film buff compared to you. I'm a novice. I'm a devotee. But you're the expert.
Well, you do just fine. I happen to know that you do just fine in this arena. Phil, if you don't know, is the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond, which he created with Ray Romano, and which enjoyed enormous success around the globe. And when I say around the globe, I mean literally, because you ought to see, if you haven't, his wonderful documentary, Exporting Raymond, which is all about Phil's adventures going to Russia.
True.
To help supervise a recreation of the show, I guess it was.
Yeah, they bought our scripts and they asked me to come over and help them make Everybody Loves Kostya. And it's on Netflix right now. They just started streaming it on Netflix.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great because I'm very fond of that film.
Thank you.
And
I think we did a show once before when it came out, right?
We did, absolutely, because nice. I meant it. I still mean it.
Thank you.
I like
you.
That film a lot.
I like your shirt, by the way.
Oh, thank you. This being an audio medium, we'll have to explain that I have a penchant for wearing polo shirts with cartoon character what do you call them? Patches on them.
You might have the best collection in the world from what I've seen.
Well, what's happened is I've had to invent them myself. I buy the patches online and have them sewn onto these shirts.
Right.
When the Warner Brothers store was alive and well and thriving, I was their best customer. Yeah. Their Warner Brothers catalog before that.
Yeah.
And when AOL bought Time Warner, they shut it all down.
Really? Why would they
do that? Unfortunate, but they said, we don't want to be in the retail business. They didn't seem to want to be in any business, but they simply didn't want to be in the retail business. And so that was a sad day for a lot of us cartoon junkies who like our merchandise.
Right. I mean, they had a lot of good stuff. I used to work – we shot Raymond on the Warner Brothers lot, and we would bring – everyone who came wanted to go to that store and always bought something. We bought stuff.
Oh, yeah.
We
and then there was that magnificent store they opened in New York on 5th Avenue and 57th Street,
a
three-story extravaganza of a store.
Right.
Opposite Tiffany's or near Tiffany's.
Yes. I mean, if you're a kid like me, you thought Bugs Bunny was funnier than Mickey Mouse, and that's the stuff you wanted.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. So alas and alack.
It's
gone. You can find stuff on eBay, but oh well.
That's all right.
The passing parade.
You have some collection, I'll bet.
Yeah. Yeah, I have the collecting bug. That's
how does,
for
how
sure.
does the wife feel about
that's
this?
For sure. Well, she's a collector too.
Oh.
Not of this. She collects other things, but we both live in glass houses, therefore, so we can't
what
throw
does
bricks
she
at each other. Royal British commemorative pieces, going back to Queen Victoria.
Today on a special episode of Hoarders.
Well, there is a line between collectors and hoarders.
Right.
I'd like to think we straddle that line at least. If we're not entirely on the other side of it, at least we're in the midst of it.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be the judge someday.
Okay.
You'll see for yourself.
Okay.
One of the reasons that I invited you here today, just to have fun talking about movies and talking about things we like, is because you are about to debut a new series on PBS.
Yes.
Which I was lucky enough to preview and fell in love with. It's called I'll Have What Phil's Having.
Isn't that nice? And I got cast as Phil.
You survived the rigorous audition process.
Right.
And cast yourself as Phil.
I didn't cast myself. They cast me. As a matter of fact, it all started with Exporting Raymond. Yeah. PBS saw that movie, and they called me in their office, and they said, we like this movie. We like the idea of you going places. I said, so does my wife. But what did you have in mind? They said, we don't know. Have you ever had an idea about travel? I said, traveling is the best thing in the world. That's my favorite thing to do. My favorite thing to do in life is to eat in Italy, right? So food and travel. And I love going to other countries, and France is not bad either, by the way. How about a show where every episode I go to a different great spot on Earth and I show you where to eat? because this I kind of know about this stuff. And they said yes. They actually said yes. They gave me 6 episodes on the air, and they asked me where I wanted to go. And I got this show, and I called my brother, and I told him I got this show. He goes, that's very interesting. What are you going to call this, The Lucky Bastard? Which was the working title for a while. Now it's the name of my production company on the show, because I truly do feel this way. But I also feel there's no more mind-expanding thing that you can do in life than travel. And for me, connecting with people has always been through food and humor. And so that's our way in, I think, not just to cultures, but to other human beings. Because all we do on the planet is look to connect with somebody, right? You and I connect over movies and a love of Warner Brothers cartoons and other great things. But I find that a sense of humor might be the most underrated value when it comes to human relations. What I mean is that obviously there's sex appeal and there's you know, the things that we think are the things that attract us to our mates. But I actually believe that the secret to a long marriage, which I'm lucky enough to have now, 25 years. How about you?
40.
All right, you win. He wins again. He wins at the movie thing. He wins at the marriage thing.
It's not not a competition.
At the collection thing.
It's okay. But we both share that, though.
The sense of humor. And even if you don't have identical sense of humor, all it takes is an appreciation of the other ones. And I think that's the secret. And I think that that sense of humor is often shared around the dining room table in our families. That's how families are created, always has been for since, you know, men came out of the bushes, right? I think that's – so what am I saying? There's an Anthony Bourdain out there, right? He's very cool. I'm telling people I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything. I feel like we watch him. And I love him. Best show on TV to me. But we're not doing that. I'm not going to Beirut to get shot at. I'm not going I'm not going to tip my dune buggy over in the dunes. I'm a guy who watches Bourdain and would never – so I figure people will watch a guy like me and say, if that putz can go outside, maybe I can too. So that's the – that's to me the best thing I could do is inspire you to come and travel. So it's a show for people who love to travel and for people who haven't had the opportunity yet.
But it's more than that. Based on the Italy episode that I did get to see and some sneak previews of the others, it's more. It's more than travel, and somehow it's more than food even. Though it's about eating and eating wonderful food and discovering local food and meeting great chefs.
It's the way in.
It's about just what you said, connecting with people, really.
Yes, because that's everything.
Yeah, but food is a great medium for that, isn't it? Or a device, whatever you want to call it.
Look at our social lives. That's what we do, right? We gather around the I'll meet you for dinner. I'll meet you for lunch. Come over. We're gonna have pizza. You know, it's that's it.
Yeah. Well, you of course. What I like about – one of the things I like about your show, I like many things about your show, but one of the things I like about it is that it seems very spontaneous and organic, which usually means a lot of work went into it to make it look spontaneous and organic. But when you do show up in these different places in Umbria and other places in Italy, in Florence, you do get to meet some great chefs and their families and their colleagues. And that puts a personal touch to it that makes it more human and less predictable. And you get to stand in the kitchen and watch a master well, she's a woman, I guess a female master, create gelato. I wanted to reach through the screen, Phil, and try that gelato.
I think you should go.
Yeah.
Don't when you watch that, doesn't it make you want to go?
Yes, if there was a travel agent standing there, I would have bought tickets. Absolutely.
I showed the Paris episode to a friend of my wife's, and she booked a trip for her family. She had never done it before. This is the best thing that people can do with their money, don't you think?
Not surprised. Sure.
Is to travel, because it changes your life.
It does. Gives you a different perspective on everything.
Yeah.
Last time I was in Europe, several years now, I was invited to a film festival in Bologna with my family.
Yeah.
and it was it was summertime, but it was still unseasonably hot, and that was a little uncomfortable. But the prosciutto pizza I had there one day still lives on in my memory.
Isn't that great?
It's one of the greatest things I've ever eaten in my life.
And when we have that, we never forget it.
Mm-hmm.
We never because it's the best of that you ever had.
Yeah.
And you can have that experience by walking into a corner place that looks like nothing, and you say, let's just eat here because we don't care. Yeah. And then the top of your head blows off.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I'm also here to say, I know that not everyone can afford to travel overseas. Mm-hmm. I was that guy.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't born wealthy. I was a courier my first trip to Europe. I worked for DHL. Their stuff came along as my excess baggage. That's how they, before they became world famous DHL, mm-hmm. that's how they did it. It was cheaper for them, rather than hiring cargo planes, mm-hmm. to send their stuff as a guy in coaches excess baggage.
Oh my goodness.
So you would have all these luggage tags and you would find the guy at the other end of the trip with a sign that said DHL. You'd hand him the luggage tags and you were free to go off on your own. You mm-hmm. did not get paid, but your trip was free to say Zurich.
Yeah.
And your friend, or your wife or your girlfriend in my case, could come the next day on that leg to Zurich. I meet up with Monica, and now we have 2 weeks in Europe.
Wow.
We have no money, but we're staying in, you know, pensiones, little mm-hmm. tiny places, and we're eating what we can afford to eat. And it's still the best trip I ever had, right? Because
wow.
if you're in Paris with your girlfriend, which I recommend, mm-hmm. things are good.
Yeah.
It helps you.
Yeah. Wow.
But you can also travel in your own town. Our last episode is Los Angeles, which I did not like when I first came here. Mm-hmm. Did you? Are you from here?
No, I'm a New Yorker. Like
me too.
You. Mm-hmm.
And when you came, did you love it right away?
No.
It's hard. It's an adjustment, right, if you're from New York?
Yes. Oh, it's a huge adjustment. There aren't two cities more different than I can think of in the world.
And Woody Allen taught me how to feel about L.A. before
yes.
I got here.
He prejudiced you.
Absolutely. I was young and impressionable, and I loved him. You know, I was that kid that went to see every single movie mm-hmm. when it opened mm-hmm. at the Beekman Theater, standing outside for 2 hours in the snow sometimes, mm-hmm. in the 80s this would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think his peak, and we'll talk about this.
Yeah.
I know we're talking about.
Yeah. We are going to get to movies, by the
yes,
way, folks.
Yes, yes.
If you think we've veered completely off course.
But
we
look
haven't.
At this transition we're making.
Well, it's an eventual transition.
Yes, okay.
Yes, an eventual transition.
Anyway, he taught me how to feel about mm-hmm. this place. And I say in the show, when I got here, I thought he had been kind. I called it Paramus with palm trees. and I couldn't – it was suburbia without the urbia. I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. And then I found a couple of places to eat that I liked. I also noticed, oh, the weather's pretty nice. I also mm-hmm. noticed that, oh, I'm working.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
makes any place yeah. better when you start finding work.
When I came out here, I guess 31 years ago, I'm losing track. A friend of mine said about the deli food. He said the deli food's getting better
yeah.
than it used to be. He says, but it's just no good having a pastrami sandwich served to you by someone who says, have a nice day.
Right.
But what's happened meanwhile in New York is all the old, nasty deli yeah. waiters have gone, like the old cab drivers.
Mm-hmm.
That's now an ancient stereotype that's
they're now
disappeared.
Studio executives. Yeah.
They have vanished, unfortunately, from the landscape.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. But, you know. A little niceness never hurt anybody.
No.
Right?
I'm not knocking it overall.
It's just a character thing.
Yes, yes.
You know that place in Chicago, the Wiener Circle, mm-hmm. where the ladies
yes, yes,
curse
yes,
at you?
They abuse you, yes,
yeah,
yes, yes.
That's
yeah.
kind of fun, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And the hot dogs are good.
I will say this.
Yeah.
This may be our segue, maybe not. You decide.
Yeah.
Alice and I had only recently moved out here.
Yeah.
When we went to a screening of Broadway Danny Rose.
Uh-huh.
So we're recent, you know, transplants from New York, still adjusting.
Yeah.
And we sit down in our seat, the lights go down, and we're at the Carnegie Deli. It's
yep.
like, oh.
You missed it. Yeah. This
aww.
Is 1984, I want to say.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a wistful moment. It's like, oh, the Carnegie. Oh.
Beautiful, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. So he took us right back there.
By the way, they recently were shut down by the city of New York for stealing gas line.
Oh, no.
They were stealing the gas from an illegal line.
Oh, my goodness. How long were they shut?
I think that's true. Please don't quote me on this,
okay.
people listening. But that's the rumor that I heard.
gosh.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to get back to this in 1 second. I just want to finish this thought about Los Angeles. It became my adopted hometown. Mm-hmm. Found things to like. Then I found things to love. And now I live here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not moving back. I go to New York quite often. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, I'm lucky enough to do everything that I used to take me a year to do. I can do in a week there. And man, I mean, yes, I've gotten soft, but it is easier to live here.
Well, yes. I always say I'm grateful that I had the first half or so of my life in New York, which
when you
taught me street
it.
Smarts.
That's right.
And
you could physically take it.
Yes.
That's how I feel.
Yes, that too.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it can be brutal.
It can. You walk outside your door, you're assaulted.
Yeah.
All your senses are assaulted, and sometimes in a stimulating and positive way,
absolutely.
And sometimes not.
It's exciting. I mean, for me still, there's no more thrilling thing to do than to walk down the street. I'll walk all the way from the Village all the way up to the Upper West Side.
The two things I miss most about New York are specific foods and walking.
Yeah.
Those are the two things.
I still walk a lot here. I try to do it. It's
hard to walk in the city.
A little bit. But I live in a nice neighborhoody type of place, and I can make
it. I do too, but it's not the same. I don't have the stimulus of the crowds and the people watching and the window shopping and
so
all that.
So people, maybe if you're listening to this podcast, you have that in your ears in L.A. and you go walking. That's what I do. I listen to podcasts. I listen to music, and time goes quickly.
Oh,
or
I
make a phone call.
Yeah.
It makes it
much nicer. No question of that.
Anyway. The point of what I'm saying is about the food and travel thing before we get off onto Broadway Danny Rails. You can travel in your own town. There's a Peruvian restaurant in the neighborhood that you're afraid to go in. And Peruvian food, I'm using as an example, as something I don't know anything about. So I'm afraid to eat it. But what if you tried it and what if you liked it? You've traveled. And let's say you really like it. And now you start to ask questions of the owner and you fall in love with them. And before you know it, you're in love with Peruvian culture and you're planning a trip to Peru. This can happen. I'm not just saying this. This can really happen to you. A great restaurant, a great place to eat, cheap, nothing, taco stand, can be a vacation. You can travel. You can be transported.
Wow.
Right? I think it's in your town. I think we all have a place in our town that we haven't tried yet, and maybe you should. And that's the point of the show, too.
Well, I think it's, as I say, I've only seen one complete episode.
Yeah.
Your voyage to Italy, as I say.
Yeah.
And it almost brought me to tears.
Oh.
It's so warm and so inviting in so many ways. And it does get you in a variety of ways that have nothing on the surface to do with specifically food or specifically travel. It's that human interconnectivity.
I'm so glad you like that. That means the world to me. And you know, there's two types of things. In comedy, when we're writing comedy, there's an exclusive sense of humor, meaning like, look at that guy over there, ha ha, or an inclusivity, which is – I'm the butt of the joke, or I'm like you. So that sensibility that maybe was in Raymond, my family's like your family, I've tried to carry over into this food and travel show.
Which debuts, let's do the proper plug here, which debuts on the 28th of September.
Yes.
On PBS stations Coast to Coast.
That's right.
And there's a website, a web page with a lot of previews and excerpts and clips, which you can find very easily. You can Google it very easily.
And you can find me on Twitter
and
Instagram.
All of that stuff.
And Facebook,
I've heard of. Phil Rosenthal?
Yeah, I'm the guy.
But also if you Google, I'll have what Phil's having.
Yeah.
You'll get a lot of advance peeks at this wonderful series.
Yeah, they put a nice website together, PBS. They've entered the modern age.
Yes, yes. They have no choice.
Yes.
None of us does.
No, I don't.
No one does. And when we now wind back the clock to a movie, now I asked you in advance of your coming here, what movie would you like to talk about? I said, what comedy would you like to talk about?
Yeah.
And you hesitated not 1 second.
No.
And you said Broadway Danny Rose.
Because it's my favorite Woody Allen movie.
Why?
It's unique in his canon in a couple of ways. One is he plays a character unlike the Woody Allen character that he played in all the other movies. We know what that is. It started early on, and, mm-hmm. and in any hall it grew up a little bit, and mm-hmm. then he kind of stayed that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Except for this, and I don't know if you know the genesis of the movie, of the backstory of the movie. He was with Mia Farrow, his girlfriend at that time, and they were in an Italian restaurant, and she pointed to a patron of the restaurant and said, "I'd like to play a lady like that one day." And that inspired Woody.
Huh.
Now, he wrote a script, and he wrote a script with an Italian singer in mind. And the person he had in mind to play that singer, do you know this?
No.
Okay. Was an actor he had worked with briefly in Bananas. And in the movie, I'm going to see if you can guess it. In that movie, this guy was a street thug on the subway.
Oh, yes, I do know who that is.
He then became famous.
Sylvester Stallone.
Exactly. He turned down Woody Allen to play the singer
in
Broadway Danny Rose to do a musical with Dolly Parton. I'll bet you know what that is. I forgot the name. That's it.
Oh, my.
Okay, so Woody sends his assistant to Colony Records.
Now gone,
on Broadway. And she brings back a bunch of Italian artists.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is a man named Nick Apolloforte.
Mm-hmm.
His picture's on the cover, mm-hmm. and Woody asks to see him and falls in love with him and gives this real Italian singer the part. You never saw him before or since.
No, talk about a one-hit wonder, yeah.
But man, was he perfect.
Oh, he is perfect, yes.
Right? What I love about the movie is that many things. Here's one thing. It so encapsulates a part of show business that to me is show business. This is the real show business. This is the business where no matter if you're Milton Berle or the one-armed juggler or the one-legged tap dancer or the guy with the parrot or the guy making balloon animals,
mm-hmm.
the business is getting a gig.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
And the bookings are run the exact same way whether you're that juggler or Milton Berle,
mm-hmm.
as in the movie. Milton Berle is seen as the height of show business. Mm-hmm. He was already passé then.
Yeah.
And that's a part of show business as well, a very specific New York, almost underbelly of show business.
Mm-hmm.
The bridge they show is not the romantic Brooklyn Bridge. It's the George Washington Bridge, mm-hmm. to New Jersey. You know what I mean? This is the world. And here's something else. He starts in the Carnegie Deli,
mm-hmm.
with real-life comedians.
Yep.
I happen to know Morty Gunte. He was a wonderful man. Did you ever meet him?
No, but I know Howie Storm, who was sitting there.
Jackie Gale.
And I knew Will Jordan, who's still going strong.
Great. And so these are real comedians, mm-hmm. sitting around. They're telling stories, as comedians, mm-hmm. do. I know they do because I have my own lunch with comedians and comedy writers, mm-hmm. and it's exactly what we do. It's almost like I grew up to want to be in that world, mm-hmm. right? The whole movie has the tone of a story being told by funny people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's slightly exaggerated, and yet it is so well constructed. If you're a writer especially, you have to admire the beautiful construction of this tale. And the way the comedy keeps paying off and the way the characterizations are played and the casting is perfect and the cinematography is perfect.
In black and white.
In beautiful, gorgeous black and white, which makes it feel classic,
mm-hmm.
right? And then the message is so charming and beautiful. The message of, he says, I have a creed, he says, and it was taught to me by, well, who was it, his parents or his grandmother or something? Do you remember?
No.
You just saw it, right?
Yeah.
Acceptance, forgiveness, and love.
Yes.
And she goes, that's a loser thinks like that, right? She's like, I say, do it to the other guy before he does it to you.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's like a line from Murder Incorporated. What are you talking about? And sure enough, acceptance, forgiveness, and love is what happens. And it's just so heartwarming. It's so atypical of him, because
mm-hmm.
usually he's very cynical.
Yeah.
If we remember Crimes and Misdemeanors,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the wedding, the blind rabbi signifies God is not watching. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no justice. The mm-hmm. murderer gets away with it. And here, it's acceptance, forgiveness, and love.
We should explain,
yes.
for those who haven't seen the movie or maybe don't remember it because it's now my gosh, 31 years old.
Wow.
31 years old. You know how old it is? They're using payphones. That's how old it is.
Even that's charming, right?
Yes. We've talked about this before with other movies set in New York in the 70s and 80s. You can tag them right away when they're not using cell phones.
Exactly. I'd argue that it was better for movies before computers. How many scenes do we see now in thrillers where they're typing?
Always.
That's exciting to people?
It's a paradigm change. Absolutely. It's a major shift.
Instead of going out and doing the legwork, we're typing.
Yes.
That's the movie.
But anyway, Broadway Danny Rose. Danny Rose, played by Woody Allen, is a is an amazing show business creature.
Yeah.
He is an eternally optimistic, almost astonishingly upbeat guy who is at the bottom rung of the show business ladder.
Right. What a great character.
Booking a blind xylophonist. And and a one-legged tap dancer and a one-arm juggler. And he loves them all, and he cares about them deeply.
Yeah.
And he is a walking assemblage of cliches in his speech patterns.
Yeah.
And it's about his relationship with one client in particular, Lou Canova.
Yep. Nick Pallaforte.
Played by Nick Pallaforte, who's two big songs. He sings a lot of songs. Mm-hmm. One is called Agita.
Amazing.
And the other is My Bambina. But Agita is the one you sort of carry in your head afterwards.
It's about heartburn.
But and then he gets involved with Lou Canova's girlfriend, played by Mia Farrow.
Unrecognizable Mia Farrow.
Yes, right. And she's,
I mean,
she's
you've never seen her like this. And she's hilarious.
Yes. And Lou Canova asks Danny Rose to be his beard because he's a married man with kids.
Right.
But he's carrying on with this woman.
With Mia.
Who is out of the Italian gangster milieu, let's say.
Tina Vitale.
Yes. I'll tell you what I take away from this movie, what took away from this movie, and I've never forgotten, and my wife and I say this to each other with amazing regularity, especially when I'm about to do a gig.
Yeah.
The three S's.
Star.
Smile, star. No, sorry. Star, smile, strong. That's what Danny Rose advises his clients. Always bearing in mind the three S's. Star, smile, strong.
Is he wrong?
No, of course not. Of course not. Oh, my. I forgot how much of the movie they shot in Jersey, too.
Yep.
They do go across the bridge.
Yep.
They're in a diner in Jersey City. They're in a warehouse. All sorts of stuff.
It's the underbelly of New York. It's that great kind of – it's the real New York.
Yes, it is.
Not glamorized in any way. Just the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? But it's about how about the betrayal and how people can be can use other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a sadness in it.
Oh,
too,
yes.
But he never feels sorry for himself until
end. There's one incredibly poignant moment that I don't want to spoil.
Right.
I don't want to give it away.
Yeah.
It comes maybe three quarters of the way through the movie, and it's the way it's set up and shot.
Yeah.
That I think is unique in all of Woody Allen's work.
Yeah.
And you'll know when you see it, folks, if you decide to revisit the movie.
You know how I saw the
Which
movie?
Is unfortunately not streamable right now. I watched a DVD this morning.
Yeah.
And you can get it on DVD in Woody Allen Collection. And if you, as some people have, if you've been using your public library to borrow DVDs, that's great.
It might even be on YouTube in some form.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's it is worth seeing or re-seeing if you haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, forget the public Woody Allen that you may like or not like. Mm-hmm. This is a real great, funny, touching, beautiful.
Yeah.
Probably I think it's special also because I happen to be in show business and in love with show business.
Sure.
I love everything about show business except the business. but this, so if you have any connection to it or love for it at all, this may be your movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think so. Seeing those comics in the Carnegie Deli, if that speaks to you.
Yes.
As it did to me when I first saw it, spoke to me again when I went back to it.
And there's these icons of New York, like the Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Right.
Right?
and casual things like Colony Records and and the Carnegie Deli.
Yes.
And Joe Franklin, the Joe Franklin Show.
Come on.
For those who don't know, and he just passed away some months ago, Joe Franklin was an institution, a New York television and radio institution.
A real Broadway Danny Rose in his way.
Exactly.
The real life one.
Precisely.
Maybe. Yeah.
Precisely. A guy who was never anything less than upbeat.
Right.
He would have on his show, Joe did a talk show for decades.
Billy Crystal made fun of him on Saturday Night Live. Yeah.
I was on the show many, many times.
Oh, yeah.
I made my television debut on the Joe Franklin show when I was 16 years old.
Wow.
And he was always very nice to me, very kind to me. But Joe would have big stars alongside the owner of the Acropolis restaurant from 8th Avenue and 47th
Fantastic.
Street. Alongside, he'd give everybody
Equal.
The same buildup.
Yeah.
I want to introduce to you the queen of country music, Yetta Frumkus. The queen of country music? Everyone got the same buildup. If you went on, as I did, as an author promoting a book, he wouldn't just hold up the book, as you prayed other talk show hosts would and never did. He'd hold it up. He'd hold up the spine. He'd name the publisher.
I wonder how many people watched that show.
Well, you know, I was told at one time that his ratings, especially when he went late night, were so low they weren't even in the ratings book.
Amazing.
But every time I went on that show, people said they saw me. I would go to the dry cleaners and the guy would say, "Hey, saw you on Joe Franklin last night." There were people out there watching. They were there.
Because he seemed like your uncle with the show.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Exactly. Exactly. If you're a Joe Franklin fan, I did write a little memorial piece when he passed away earlier this year.
I'll
if you go to my website, leonardmalton.com, you can wallow in some Joe Franklin nostalgia. So that's Broadway Danny Rose.
I got to see it at a screening, an advanced screening in New York. I took a class maybe, and Jack Rollins came to talk about it. That's how I know these stories.
Jack Rollins and Charlie Jaffe were Woody's longtime managers and producers of his movies.
And the way they became his managers was they went to a comedy club and they saw him in the Village, and this little nebbishy, skinny kid got up and was so petrified that he wrapped himself in the microphone cord during the act. They thought he was going to strangle himself. And Jack Rollins said the bravest person he's ever seen in his life was Woody Allen at this time, because he was so nervous to get on stage and yet did so and bombed for 2 years before he started catching on.
Wow.
Every single night for 2 years.
Hard to imagine. No, I'm just looking up the year of something. So when I refer to it in a minute, I will.
They
believed in him.
Boy, did they. They started managing him as a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did television work, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
He was a writer for Sid Caesar with these greats. And he was the youngest of them.
Right.
And he was in the company of Neil Simon, Larry Gelbart, Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, you know, these are the giants.
Right.
They all came from working for Sid Caesar. Our whole comic sensibility comes from that one guy.
Yes. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. It's a Valentine kind of. It's a Valentine to the, as you say, the nether world of show business.
Which is 99% of show business.
Yes.
We only see the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
The famous, you know, not everybody's Tom Hanks. There's one Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Right?
Now, what I wanted to bring up was in 2006, some years after Broadway Danny Rose, he did kind of return to this character in Scoop. In Scoop, which he shot in England with Scarlett Johansson, he plays a third-rate magician.
You're right.
And he is one of Danny Rose's clients.
You're right.
And he's so funny.
Absolutely.
He's so funny doing that. And he keeps calling volunteers from the audience and saying thanking them and saying, "You're a credit to your race." It's a very funny
hilarious.
Bit.
I think this shtick. Period, though, the Mia Farrow years, built on the Diane Keaton years in terms of content and writing and just craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that the Mia Farrow years are his peak years.
Hmm.
If we look back at his career.
Purple Rose of Cairo is one of his best.
Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of really good work.
Yep.
And
Hannah and Her Sisters.
Hannah and Her Sisters.
Gorgeous movie.
Yep.
Right? Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yeah.
These are all good. Alice is good. Trying to think, there's more. Zelig is really good.
Mm-hmm.
I just love these. Radio Days is wonderful.
Oh, Radio Days, another New York Well, I mean, all of Woody Allen's films from that period are New York movies, to one degree or another.
He says Radio Days is his most autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was like growing up for him.
Yeah. Yeah. And it scans. It follows.
And then when the scandal happened with Mia Farrow, I don't know if it's just because this is how I felt about him personally, disappointed personally, but I don't think the movie's ever recovered either. For me, I think there were moments, but the consistency is gone for me. And I do wish that he would slow down. He needs to make a movie every year, he said, because it helps distract him from the thought of death.
Yeah.
So he doesn't – he almost doesn't care that he's he's not taking the time that maybe a movie should take. He knows in May he's doing this part of a production,
right,
and in January he's doing this part of a production, and it's released at this time every year, and he's he has a working schedule. But I think maybe now they'd be a little bit better, the films, maybe more like the ones that I love from the 70s and 80s, if he slowed down. But who am I to say?
Well, every now and then he still hits one out of the park.
I think
I thought Vicky Cristina Barcelona was awfully good.
It was great.
And Midnight in Paris I loved. And that was turned out to be his biggest hit ever.
I know. I like that movie, but I don't know. There's so many movies that I think it's derivative of from his great movies that I said, yes, this is good. I like the idea of that movie more than I think I like the movie.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
But I certainly understand why people love it. I'm just like a crazy kind of student of the work. So I see where everything in that movie comes from.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And by the way, all of it comes from. All of his movies have roots in his stand-up comedy. And if you are if you like him at all, go get the albums.
Oh, well,
the stand-up years.
If you didn't grow up seeing him on television, seeing him in nightclubs, or listening to the comedy albums, you really owe it to yourself to discover the stand-up Woody on those comedy albums, because those are such they're like finely honed gems. They're diamonds. They're such wonderfully funny routines.
I think it's the best stand-up comedy record in history is this Woody Allen, the stand-up years. If you want to go hear like the best material you've ever heard, it's kind of genius.
Yeah, well, and not kind of.
It is genius.
It is genius, truly.
Yeah.
And I remember going to see his first film and what that was like. And you know what? We'll talk more about that. I realize we've been talking and talking. We haven't taken a break yet.
And somebody has to go to the bathroom, I'm sure, out there.
Yeah.
If not in here.
So you know what we'll do? We'll take a break. Friends, I'm excited to introduce you to Howl FM, the best, most convenient way to listen to all the episodes of Maltin on Movies. It's on the web at Howl FM and on the go with the Howl app. You can stream and download all Maltin on Movies episodes that have been released in the past 6 months. Go beyond the audio with behind-the-scenes photos, commentaries, and more. You can even go further by upgrading to Howl Premium for only $4.99 a month. Get exclusive access to the entire Maltin on Movies archive and to all the Earwolf and Wolf Pop archives. This includes all episodes older than 6 months. They've all been remastered and have no advertising. Only with Howl Premium, listen to hundreds of hours of Marc Maron's WTF archives. You can hear classic interviews with Robin Williams, Louis C.K., many, many more. And Howl has also partnered with some of your favorite hosts and comedians to develop Howl Originals. Those are brand new shows available only with Howl Premium. You can check out the great new series from Lauren Lapkus and the AV Club right now. There are already 10 brand new hilarious Howl Originals. We're adding new shows every week. Get access to all this exclusive content both on your phone and on your desktop with Howl Premium for only $4.99 a month. And with the promo code MALTIN, that's M-A-L-T-I-N, you get a full month of a free trial. Try it out. Go to Howl FM and enter code MALTIN at checkout. Remember, you can use Howl on your phone or your computer, but you can only use my promo code on Howl FM, the website. So go to Howl FM, that's H-O-W-L.fm, and use the promo code MALTIN, M-A-L-T-I-N, for one free month trial of Howl Premium. Give it a try. I'm Leonard Maltin. Welcome back to Maltin on Movies with my very special guest, Phil Rosenthal.
Hello.
Happy to have you here.
I love being here.
And we're reminiscing about Woody Allen's early days, and I remember going to see Take the Money and Run, his first self-made movie. Now, he'd already been in What's New Pussycat.
Right.
And he had done that funny little parody movie.
What's Up, Tiger Lily,
which is still very funny.
It is.
Where he took a James Bond, an Asian James Bond movie, a cheesy Asian James Bond ripoff, and put a hilariously non sequitur soundtrack on it. My old friend Frank Buxton was one of his collaborators on that. It's just so funny.
Yep.
They're searching for an egg salad recipe.
It's really a cartoon.
Really, really funny.
Yeah.
But the first movie that he legitimately acted in, wrote, and directed was Take the Money and Run.
Mm-hmm.
And watching him develop and refine his abilities and his chops and his technique as a filmmaker as well as an actor and comedian was fascinating.
And the jokes were so good.
Always.
He played a cellist in a marching band. So he had to keep picking up his chair, setting it down, playing, picking up his chair, setting it down, playing.
The other line that my wife and I always say to each other is from Take the Money and Run.
Yeah.
I have a gub.
I have a gub, sure.
He shows that he wants to rob a bank and he gives the hold up note to the teller. And the teller is trying to read his handwriting.
I have a gub.
I have a gub? No, that's gun. That's an N. Oh, it looks like a B.
Looks like a B. And what letter is this? And that, hilarious.
So I have a gub has become a catchphrase in our household.
Great.
It's a fascinating career to watch from any point of view, from any vantage point.
And you know what? Love the art, not the artist. You don't have to love him, but you do have to appreciate the work.
Yeah.
He should not – this man should not be forgotten.
No, of course not. Of course not. I found it interesting, too. You were talking about that school of Sid Caesar writers.
Yeah.
And many of them went on to make movies. And a lot of their especially early work reflects the same kind of New York, often Jewish sensibility.
Yeah.
I mean, Carl Reiner made a movie out of Enter Laughing, his autobiographical play.
Right.
About his experiences as a young actor.
Yep.
And what was Mel Brooks' first movie? The Producers.
Still one of the greatest comedies of all time.
And a very perverse New York, gritty New York movie.
Yeah.
Talk about the underbelly of show business.
Hilarious.
And when he did the musical play and then the musical film, he cleaned it up. He shined it up.
He did.
Too much for my taste.
Uh-huh.
The movie is really perverse.
It is in a great way.
Yes.
You say that in a good way.
In a good way, yes. I mean it as a compliment. I do. I do mean it as a compliment.
Yeah. Biggest – How about this? The best huge performance ever in a movie.
Zero Mustache.
Yes, mm-hmm. Is that movie.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Because it's so focused.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot of big stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't always score. And you're going, it's too big, stop.
Yeah.
But he is side-splittingly funny.
Yes. And Gene Wilder in that film is just impossibly good. Because you believe him.
Yes.
You believe him.
Yes.
I'm not going to name names about other people who played that role in subsequent years.
Uh-huh.
But they all seem to be doing a farce. They're playing farce. Gene Wilder made that guy, Leo Bloom, real.
The two of them.
And when Zero Mostel throws the cup of water at him, he says, I'm wet.
I'm wet. Hysterical.
I mean, he's a funny and pathetic individual all at the same time.
And you care for him.
And you care for him and you care about what's going to happen to him.
And even as big as Zero Mostel is, you feel bad for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Amazing. Amazing. Well, another movie that I wanted to bring up, and you did when we had a brief phone conversation about this, it's kind of a cousin, you might say, to Broadway Danny Rose.
Yep.
A dirtier...
maybe a grandpa.
More lethal cousin or grandfather.
Yeah.
Is Sweet Smell of Success.
One of the best movies of all time.
Yes, indeed, from 1957.
And maybe the most cynical.
It's what a tough movie.
Yeah.
Tough as nails.
Like New York.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, and they shot all the exteriors in Manhattan, and it's a wonderful kind of time capsule.
Yes.
Of late 50s New York, Manhattan in that moment.
Boy, does that look great. It really looks great.
Yeah, I think that's James Wong Howe who photographed that, also in black and white.
Like a living work of art.
Oh, it is extraordinary. extraordinary. This is the film where Burt Lancaster plays J.J. Hunsaker,
right,
a powerful Walter Winchell-like columnist who can make or break careers, and does, and a slimy, sycophantic press agent played by Tony Curtis, who will do anything to get his clients' names mentioned favorably in Hunsaker's column.
Right.
And when we say anything, he will do anything.
Right. Not a lot of laughs in that movie.
No.
But it is the underbelly of show business, too. Yeah, yeah. Maybe Broadway to Danny Rose is the comic version of that.
Yeah, the two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
Interesting.
My favorite line from that movie, hate to take a bite out of you, Sydney, you're a cookie full of arsenic.
Whoa, man.
Right?
Did you get the Criterion edition of that?
Well, I recommend it.
One of the joys, if you're a collector or a connoisseur of DVDs and Blu-rays, Criterion is kind of the gold standard in that field. They put out just a couple of years ago their edition of Sweet Smell of Success, and they did something that I will be forever grateful for.
Yeah.
In the booklet that accompanies the film, there's usually a good essay or two by a film critic or scholar, but they published two short stories that Ernest Lehman wrote in about 1950, magazine stories, about J.J. Hunsaker and Sidney Falco.
No kidding.
And they're great. Because there's always been a question of, well, who really wrote this movie? Because Clifford Odets, the celebrated playwright, has his name on the screenplay as well.
Yeah.
And some people would have you believe that it was Odets who came in and rewrote Ernest Lehman and made the film what it is today, what we all admire so much. But go back and read these original short stories of Ernest Lehman.
Oh, great, I will.
And you see, it's all there. It's all there in these stories. And Odets obviously made a big contribution, too.
Yeah.
But it's a collaboration. It's the result of both men's work. And those stories are awfully, awfully good.
Do you know the Criterion folks?
Yeah.
I've gotten to know them over the years now. And I did my first, like, on-camera special edition kind of supplement thing for Tootsie.
Oh, great.
Speaking of New York comedies.
Sure.
Right? Maybe the best comedy that's come out in the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a work of genius.
Yes. And again,
but you know, I'm mentioning it because there's kids out there listening who don't know that movie.
Yeah, I know.
If you can believe that.
Time goes by,
and
you, if you're in our age bracket or anywhere near it, you lose track of the fact that these movies are now getting to be 25, 30, 35 years old.
But they're hugely influential on everything that came after.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Tootsie is a classic.
I think if you release that today, it's the best comedy out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of competition.
Now we take a dark turn on this show and we trash every film that's come out since Tootsie.
No. I still see some good ones.
You do? Yeah, you were telling me you were just at Telluride?
Telluride, yes. Not a lot of comedies there. In fact, hardly. No. Telluride is a festival of serious movies for the most part.
Right.
And
Oscar bait.
Oscar bait, indeed. Saw some very good ones, but not a lot of laughs.
Are you allowed to share with us some of your
things
to look forward to?
Yeah, because they've been written up by other people. Yeah. One of the best films I saw there, maybe the best film I saw there, is opening in October. It's called Spotlight, directed by Tom McCarthy, whose work I like very much. Mm-hmm. The man who made The Station Agent and The Visitor.
Yeah, great.
And Win-Win.
Yeah.
A lot of other credits. He's also a very talented actor. He co-wrote and directed this film with a killer cast: Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Rachel McAdams, Liev Schreiber, a lot of other good people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the 2001 adventure or exploits of the Boston Globe investigative reporting team that wanted to break the story about sexual abuse in the Boston Archdiocese.
Mm.
And they wanted to do it right. They wanted to get the whole story.
Yeah.
They didn't just want one incident. They wanted to really lay it all out.
Yeah.
And this film is paced and set up like a thriller.
Yeah.
The closest comparison I could make is to All the President's Men. It's
this
kind
is
of
a
like
high,
All the President's
High praise,
Men.
Because that's a great.
So that's a hell of a film.
Yeah.
And then I got to see a sneak of Danny Boyle's new movie Steve Jobs with the script by Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
Where the great Michael Fassbender,
yeah,
and he is great, plays Steve Jobs. And that's a pretty dazzling film, too.
Oh, great. I can't wait.
Dazzling.
He's such a great writer.
But one of the other highlights of the weekend, which I did write about on my website. Did I mention my website? LeonardMaltin.com? If I didn't, I should. LeonardMaltin.com. It was the world premiere of the newly discovered complete print of Laurel and Hardy's The Battle of the Century from 1927.
Wow.
The film which they staged the world's biggest pie fight. Reel one has existed, and a little piece of the pie fight survived because it was used in a compilation feature called The Golden Age of Comedy.
Yeah.
But the rest of reel two was gone, disappeared, missing. And as you know, old film on volatile nitrate stock could and did for many years and still does disintegrate or go up in flames.
Yep.
It congeals. It literally congeals.
Yep.
Someone found a reel two. There's still a little piece of bridging footage missing between the end of reel one and the beginning of reel two.
Uh-huh.
But Serge Bromberg, the great film archivist and scholar, who's also a wonderful showman when he presents this stuff, showed recent restorations of a Chaplin film, The Bank, from 1915, 100 years ago. A Keaton film, Daydreams, from 1922.
He's my favorite.
And then Laurel and Hardy in The Battle of the Century. And I got to introduce the program. No one has. No one.
Are you going to play it here in L.A.?
Well, it'll play, and it'll eventually be on home video, I'm sure. But to see it with an audience and to see it with an excited audience that was really primed for it was just great.
Big laughs.
Just great, yes.
Wow.
Huge laughs.
Isn't that
huge?
Great?
So that was wonderful. And then a great documentary, which is going to get some other film festival exposure and then be released to theaters, called Hitchcock Truffaut, all about
their relationship,
the enterprise of François Truffaut interviewing Hitchcock for that famous
book. Yeah.
We all remember that book.
Yeah.
An incredible book, one of a kind, where one master filmmaker interviews another master filmmaker about every one of his films. And this wonderful documentary by Kent Jones explores how it came about.
Mm-hmm.
He uses the original audio tapes,
the
original photographs that were taken during the sessions.
Great.
And then talks to top filmmakers of today, David Fincher, Rick Linklater, Martin Scorsese, a bunch of others, about their feelings about Hitchcock and what they learned and what they take from Hitchcock in their consciousness and how much they admire Hitchcock. And so it's a wonderful film. For film buffs, it's just like a nirvana. It's called Hitchcock Truffaut, Hitchcock Truffaut. And watch for it, because it'll be playing and then it'll be available for, I'm sure, for streaming, downloading, and eventually on disc.
I can't wait. You just named three or four things I got to see.
Good stuff. It's all good stuff.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for dropping by.
I loved it.
And talking New York movies, talking about Woody Allen, talking about Sweet Smell of Success. We could go on about New York movies forever, of course.
Of course.
There's so many that we love. Tootsie is another great one to mention.
Well, Tootsie is a marvel because it took the oldest trope in the book, a guy in a dress. I mean, they've been doing that since ancient Greek times and made it relevant to today's world.
Yes.
How do we make that funny again and relevant? And they did a brilliant job.
And by the way, who wrote that?
Larry Gelbart and uncredited Elaine May.
Right. Yeah. But Larry Gelbart, another of the Sid Caesar writers.
You got it.
Amazing. Amazing. If you did a family tree, kind of a line, a genealogy thing about how much influence. And Neil Simon, we have to take a minute.
Yeah.
Let's take a minute to talk about Neil Simon.
Yeah.
Neil Simon and his brother, Danny,
were
part of that team also.
Yep.
And Neil Simon later decided he wanted to write plays.
Mm-hmm.
And he struggled at that for a while and finally had a hit called Come Blow Your Horn. And then there was no stopping him.
Well, I think to this day, the most successful playwright who ever lived.
Yes. Not much mentioned because he never got respect. Or not never. He didn't get a lot of respect because comedy doesn't get a lot of respect.
That's it. And what? Some of the stuff feels dated now, but only because you've seen it before because he did it and influenced everyone who came after.
Yeah.
Including me and my show owes a great debt to the work of Neil Simon.
Which ones are your favorites of his?
His movies?
Yeah.
Well, I think you got to love The Odd Couple, right?
Sure.
The Sunshine Boys has a special place in my heart.
Another show business movie.
It's like watching another New York movie, a very New York movie.
Yes.
It's like for me, my dad is very much like that. So that's like watching home movies for me, The Sunshine Boys. And it's our family. I would say in the Rosenthal house, meaning my parents, my brother, me, our favorite movie. Like the family loves this. Walter Matthau, my favorite actor. Loved him to death. Got to meet him.
What's
once.
Not
did
to
you,
love?
Yeah. Did you ever meet him?
Yes, I did.
Was he charming and great and hilarious?
Oh, he was wonderful. He enjoyed being curmudgeonly, but with a wink.
Oh,
with a wink
just,
in his eye.
There's nobody like him. Yeah. Nobody. Nobody. No. I wish he was still here.
Yeah.
I got to go to his memorial. That was special.
Oh, yeah.
Did you go to that?
I did. I was there.
Do you remember Red Buttons was the first one to speak? And as he was crossing up to the podium, he looked at us and said, "You work where you can." But I love them so much. We were, and I'm not kidding. He was my favorite actor, and I was working on the Universal lot, and we're pulling into the lot one day, and there's Walter Matthau standing outside the guard gate at Universal. And I'm like, holy crap. It's Walter Matthau. Excuse me, sir. Can we say hi to you? And he leaned his gigantic frame into our car window. So his half his body is in a car with us. And he's going, "Hello, boys. How are you?" Like this. And we're saying, "It's just so great to meet you. You're my favorite actor." And behind us, because we're at the guard gate, honk, right?
Right.
And he leans his whole body out of the window and goes to the car. "Can't you see we're having a conversation?" And leans his body back into the car.
Oh.
And we were crying laughing, and he was just so charming and so wonderful.
Did anybody ever have a better entree to stardom than Billy Wilder gave him in The Fortune Cookie?
Holy cow.
As Whiplash Willie?
Yeah, but he delivered.
And he'd already been giving great performances.
Yes.
But he was not a star.
No, but he had range, right?
Yes,
he could play a villain. He could play... He was the greatest. So, yes, and a perfect performance. The two of them, George Burns and him, unbelievable. Richard Benjamin, we know a little bit, and he played the nephew in the movie. So Jack Benny was supposed to be Walter Matthau's co-star, and they actually started filming, and Jack Benny died 2 weeks into filming. They had to shut down for a while, and then they asked Jack's best friend, George Burns, if he would do the role. And George is now very old, and I think it took some doing to get him. And Richard Benjamin said at the table read, this frail man comes in, it's George Burns, and he sits down, and they start reading the script aloud at the table reading, and George isn't opening his script, and Richard Benjamin is next to him, and he thinks, should I tell him that we've started, and that, you know, he thinks he's totally out of it. And his part is coming up. Should I tell him to open the, we're on page 32 now and you should be – and it he freezes. Richard Benjamin freezes. He can't say anything. And it comes to the part. He'll let somebody else handle, you know, signaling Mr. Burns or telling him we're here now. And his part comes and he says the first line. And then he says the next line. He's memorized the whole thing and knows it by heart and is genius and won an Oscar.
Yep.
Right?
And built himself a whole new career. A whole new career.
From that movie.
From that movie.
From 1975, I want to say.
Something like that, yeah.
Wow, I love that movie. So that's another great New York. And it's also New York backstage. Look at these things we're pulling out, right?
Yes, it's true.
Actually, by accident, we just stumbled on.
I went to see a couple of, at least a handful of Neil Simon's plays on Broadway.
Me too.
And I've never heard laughter like that in a theater.
No, he was a craftsman.
Talk about great joke writing.
Well, he knew like he was building a cathedral of laughs.
Yeah.
You know? It was like a machine.
Yeah.
But always felt real and earned, and you never thought that that's, you know, you were in the middle of something being constructed around you. You were just laughing.
Yeah. I mean, just And they all went to the same school and learned their craft.
Yeah.
Come to think of it, Woody Allen had something else in common with the film we just finished talking about a few minutes ago. Woody Allen, his first paid work,
yes,
was writing jokes for Walter Winchell and other columnists.
That's right. That's right.
He was a teenager, and he'd make money.
Yep.
Sending in these little one-liners that would be attributed to Winchell or to someone else.
You know who else did that? I don't know if it was for Winchell, but Norman Lear.
Really?
Oh, yes.
My. Mm-hmm. And Ernest Lehman, who wrote Sweet Smell of Success and many other great movies after that, started out, you know, in that same field. He was a press agent.
Mm-hmm.
He knew the territory. He really knew the territory, and that's why that film is so razor sharp.
Yeah.
Gosh, we could go on.
Of course, and we will over pizza.
Another time. That's a deal. That's a deal. Folks, thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm very happy to have this time with the wonderful Phil Rosenthal. I want to encourage you again to look out for his new PBS show, I'll Have What Phil's Having. And if you haven't seen his documentary, Exporting Raymond, it's now streaming on Netflix. And it's awfully good.
Thank you.
It really is. Very entertaining, very funny, but also very insightful. And that's a pretty good parlay, I think. If you're not sick of me, you can find me between now and our next podcast at leonardmalton.com online or on Twitter at Leonard Malton. It's been a pleasure to have you here, Phil.
Love being with you. You're a gift to the people.
Ah, God bless you. Thank you, folks. See you next time.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's me, Darren Toblerone. You might have heard me and my brother Aaron Toblerone on the California Supreme Wind Show, the only podcast all about California Supreme Windows, just minutes from the 405, your number one spot to get great deals on windows and now also door. But there are many more podcasts than just my brother's podcast. It's true, like with special guest Lauren Lapkus, for example. Every week she plays a different character and she's the guest of someone else who's playing another character who's the host. It's complicated, but it's also not. But it's also great, almost like a jigsaw puzzle. Listen to this.
Get off your knees, you damn idiot.
Oh, I love you, Regina.
Stand up. I'm going to give you osteoporosis in your knees with my cane. Stand up, you idiot.
I will, master.
Put on this ball gag, you bitch. Take it out. You liked it too much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mommy.
So sit by your favorite window and listen to with special guest Lauren Lapkus on earwolf.com, iTunes, or the podcast player of your choice. Doinky windows forever. Goodbye.
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.